much of the power is transmitted. And when you have 2.0, what is the percentage of the signal that is being emitted? Anybody knows? And 2XGN.
Hey, C2PO.
Yes, Jeff.
Hey, good evening, Roy. Well, that's on the before the first reflection, and assuming, making a lot of assumptions, but that, you can read that right from a table, Wesley, and I'm sure you've got the table sitting right in front of you, as do I. So 1.5 is 96%, and 2.0 is 88.9%. But the signal bounces back and forth, and certain portion of it is radiated each time it reaches the antenna, as you no doubt know. Go ahead, Wesley.
Am I coming out now?
Someone's transmitting a carrier.
1234, 1234. Am I coming out?
Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, I was asking what is the difference because 2.0 is 75% and it was 88.4 when I heard properly. I'm curious what the difference comes from. Who's right? And to actually,
I'll let Roy handle it. I'm just reading it off the first table I found online. But as you know, the signal bounces back and forth many times, so. I'm not sure really what the question is, but Roy will certainly know. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay. Well, you know, as Jeff mentioned, there's, you know, I actually came up with a website that says a cheat sheet, and they have approximations. The way that they give you return power approximation is 1-to-1, obviously, is 0. 2-to-1 is 10%. 3-to-1 is 25%. 6-to-1 VISWA is 50%. 10-to-1 is 65%. So these are just theoretical calculated, and especially in this little cheat sheet where they tell you to print it out, cut it, and put it in your wallet for future references. There are a number of things that affect the ability of an antenna to work. It definitely should be resonant. It definitely should be impedance matched for the optimal transfer of power. It should be low ohmic resistance. All of its resistance should be radiation resistance that goes out into RF radiation rather than ohmic heat. And it should have a proper gain and takeoff angle so it directs the signal at the place that you would like it to direct.
You might be right. It depends which table we're looking at. It was about 30 years ago when I memorized those numbers. So 2.0 is 75%. Anybody who can give the right number for it, 2.0, what is the percentage of the signal transmitted? And to HG.
KD2FIU with some input.
Yeah, George, please. Unfortunately, as I was mentioning to Wes, it's sort of splitting hairs at this point. I mean, yeah, you could do the math. There's other factors, unfortunately, that are introduced to this, so it's not a purely theoretical construct. But sure, tell us the numbers you have.
My input is not about numbers, it's about other factors. Keep in mind that we could transmit on HF and VHF and UHF with the manufactured ham radio equipment that we know of now, in the past, and in the homebrew years. Best is between 40 and 75 ohms. And it could be 78 or 80 ohms, or 38 ohms of the interface to the feed line. And depending upon how well constructed and what materials of construction that your final sections can handle is going to determine the relative impedance. So if we're going for antennas that are resonant anywhere in that range, or tuners that can bring the antennas resonant in that range, the loss of power is relative to so many factors within those ranges. So if you're going to say, I'm going to lose 10%, I'm going to lose 5%, I'm going to lose 3%, what impedance are you hitting an antenna with? What is the impedance of, that your finals can tolerate? What are the, is the impedance that your driver to your finals can tolerate? All of this construction is really irrelevant. You want test equipment to bring you into what you know that your radio is going to be satisfied with. So if we're going to say that I have a 500 ohm antenna, let me let it drop, and I'm bringing it in with a T-Match manual tuner, and I'm giving it a 50 ohm radio impedance into a 75 ohm cable that is going into that T-Match that is going out on a 50 ohm cable. We have no answers. There are no answers to that right now. So we're looking at charts that are totally optimal for 50 to 50 to 50. KD2FIU.
Yes, George, and that's kind of what I prefaced my response when I sent it over to you, that these are theoretical calculations that are all fine and dandy, but are not the ultimate. They're the starting point, if you will. There's a lot of other things that factor into the real world. So, again, we're agreeing with each other. As a matter of fact, I prefaced the turning it over to you with just that, you know, viewpoint. So we agree.
Thank you, Roy. And keep in mind, a lot of equipment can tolerate it in the exciter stage, and a lot of equipment cannot tolerate it in the exciter stage. And that's probably the first thing that we want to focus on, how our equipment tolerates it, and then try and go within a range of impedance. The amount of reflection, you know, you don't want to lose more than 10 or 20% because it's going to be irrelevant at 100 watts. You don't want to lose 10 or 20% if you're running high power because you're sending it off to a lot of heat and destroying your exciter stage and maybe your feed line, and maybe your Balun transformer equipment. So, yes, you do want to monitor. You do want to engineer your station, your feed line, and your antenna to tolerate this all within an SWR range of under 1.5, even under 2-to-1 if you have a final or exciter stage that can handle up to 2-to-1. And a lot of people think that it's very optimal. Like if you're running older equipment and you're running 100 watts, is it different whether you're running 90 watts or 110 watts? Well, make sure that the exciter stage and driver stage are not being deteriorated. And by the way, in newer equipment, much newer equipment, the driver stages are multiple stages, and they will burn out more quickly than the exciter stage.
Yeah, George, but also most of them have fold-over circuits, so what ends up in the end is they simply supply a lot less output power. So the feedback, the reflected power, is limited as well. And one thing that I always like to point out to relative new amateur radio operators out there, everyone is pretty much aware of S-units. A well-calibrated signal strength S-unit indicator on your HF equipment, a single one S-unit difference is four times the power being received than one S-unit less. So in other words, if you're getting a signal that's S6, and the guy at the other end quadruples his power, you will only see at best an additional S-unit improvement. So, you know, keep in mind that if you're tweaking things for 5% or 10%, you know, it's all good, but ultimately, as far as S-units are concerned, it won't even make the needle move a bit. So, thing to keep in mind.
KD2FIU. Roy, that's correct. To really make a difference, you got to start with doubling, and then doubling power after that, and then doubling power after that. Those are the only ways you will make a difference. Thank you, Roy. KD2FIU clear.
Okay, I couldn't make out the audio of the person who was just transmitting. I don't know if someone's transmitting just a carrier or what's going on, but give it another try, I guess.
Very good that you mentioned about power and doubling power, because you only make good steps when you double power and double that power and double power after that. KD2FIU. Thank you, Roy.
Okay, very good. You know, some people love QRP. Some people love QQRP. I like my linear amplifier. I usually don't crank it all the way up. Mine only goes to 1.3 kilowatts, but I usually use it at around 500 or 600 watts when I'm using it, but it's nice to have. But each to their own. There are people out there that would never buy a linear amplifier that think that anyone can make a contact with more than 10 watts. It's a pro that can do it with 5 or even less than 5. And it's all good. It's all fun. If it's giving you enjoyment, you're doing it right. If it's giving you an ulcer, you're doing it terribly wrong. Any other comments before we call this session a day and bring on the SpaceNet report? I just want to make sure, because of the delays that Echolink introduces, I'm not missing someone.
Yeah, I have a few things, a short one, if you allow me.
Okay, Wesley, just try and keep it short and keep in mind that there's some guy out there who's in a bad mood. And that I really want to hand it over to Apulsa.
It's creating a problem. I'm going to do something. So I'm going to come later. I direct my antenna directly to the repeater. I'm using 5 watts only. Let me jump. Okay. So we have a Q factor. How the Q factor impacts the antenna bandwidth.
KG2RY.
Yes, David?
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody. Roy, I just wanted to tell you that I have a question or a topic, but I'll ask next week.
Okay, David, I appreciate it because we are running late. And Wesley, do you want to maybe table the discussion of Q Factor for next week? Because I really want to bring Paul out. You know, I try and make his session start somewhere around 10:15. And this sounds like it could be a long topic.
Okay, so for the next week, there will be Q Factor, capacitive head, loaded antenna, the terms. What do they mean? Unloading coils. What do they mean, and why do we need to know it? Thank you very much, and thanks to you.
Okay, sure thing, no problem. I think I've written at least one or two articles in the club newsletter on the subject, and I had more than a few conversations with Dick about shortened antennas and resultant radiation resistant loss and its impact in efficiency of antennas. So we'll make that a date for next Sunday when I hope I'm able to use my radios instead of my Echolink. But I'm glad that I have the option tonight. So with that in mind, I don't want to delay it anymore. I want to thank everyone for their participation tonight and for their patience and understanding that you have to kind of let the repeater go through its cycle. Otherwise, I can't respond to anyone anymore. So thanks to everyone tonight, and I hope next Sunday is going to be a lot better than it has been this Sunday. So, Paul, WS2N, please give us the SpaceNet report.
Okay, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N. Very good. And that was great hearing Andy on, hearing all about the circles. It was close to Pi Day. Pi Day is March 14th. And, what's unique about that, Einstein's birthday is on that date, March. He's on Pi Day. So, very good. Yeah, there's a lot of little topics here, and I like to spot up for the ham topic, which two hams went outside the International Space Station last week on the 15th, Caleb Aaron and Roger Chari. Caleb is KI5LAL, and Roger is KI5LIU. So you can tell they all get their call letters down in Houston with the fives. But most astronauts, you'll see they all have fives for call letters. Anyway, they went outside on an EVA to set up a couple of, let's call them truss sections. They had to actually assemble these triangular pieces using the pistol grip tool of PGT, which is nothing but a fancy battery-operated drill that they could put all different size sockets into. And they attached these, a couple of them were pretty long, about 10 feet long, these prefabricated pieces to the outside of right near one of the solar panels. The idea is to set this up, these struts, for eventually bringing up a couple of ROSAs, R-O-S-A, Rollout Solar Array, that they're adding to the space station. They're going to bring another set up with the Dragon spacecraft in the future, and they'll do another EVA and attach the ROSAs to these stanchions that they attach to the S4 section. The solar panels on the space station add up to around 160 kilowatt system. So they could produce that amount of power on a regular basis, whether it's night or day. In the daytime, they use the solar arrays, and and there's plenty of extra power charging the batteries, and the ninth battery is discharged, and supply the space station with plenty of power, the equivalent of what they always say 40 homes, you know. But anyway, it's 160,000 kilowatts of power. It used to be a lot more, but they degrade over time. These solar panels have lost their ability to create a full charge over the years since the beginning in 2000 when they started sending these things up. So now they're replacing them. They've already done one set last year. They finished that early last year. And now they're doing another set. But these two hams had their work cut out for them. They went along with no problems. The previous crew that went out a couple of years ago, they had some problems aligning things. It took them a while to do it. They didn't have any extra time. Kayla and Roger did have extra time, so they sent them on a get-ahead project on the other, on the port side of the space station to, they wanted to pull some thermal blankets back where eventually the robotic arm will be able to disconnect these charging units if that comes to pass in the future if they have problems with them. So they did very good. So we're looking forward to SpaceX setting up a Dragon cargo vehicle around October with a new set of solar arrays. When all of them are done, they're going to do two more sets, a total of three sets on the International Space Station that they're going to use. The fourth one they don't need, so they'll have a total of three. So they'll get their power from 160 kilowatts up to around 210, 220 kilowatts. So that'll be plenty to last them until at least 2030. Right now, the space station is good up until that time. Let me drop it. Any questions, comments? And I'm gonna make sure I leave plenty of time for backup linking in case you have to get in there, Roy. Or if anybody else is on Echo Link, for that matter. Now, the ISS is still, all operations are still normal, even with all the problems in the world with Russia and the Ukraine. In fact, they launched three Russians to the space station on the 18th. So that's 2 days ago. And then in two orbits, that's all it took, roughly 4.5 hours, they docked with the International Space Station. And they really got good at that. It used to take them a couple of days on a regular basis, but now they have it timed exactly perfect. When the International Space Station is directly overhead over Kazakhstan, where the Baikonur launch facilities are, they launch just at the right second, and they're able to dock with the space station in two orbits instead of sometimes six or eight orbits. And, they've gone from 2 days all the way down to, 4 hours, 4.5 hours over the years. So they really have gotten good at cutting back the time that they have to spend in that small Soyuz spacecraft cramped up. This time it was three cosmonauts that went up. They joined seven other people on board. There's two cosmonauts already up there. There's four people that were brought up by the. I think it was the third crew mission by SpaceX a while back. So you have the three Americans, you have four Americans, and you have one European guy from Germany, and the other two were from Russia as well. Anyway, now you have a total of 10 people. They sent the picture down. They always send a group picture down right after they dock. And sure enough, they showed a picture of the all 10 people on board the space station. And that'll stay like that for a little while. You know, it seems like it gets crowded up there, but there is now plenty of room on that space station with at least 16 modules that you can go between from one to the other. You know, so now you're going to have another crew coming down at the end of this month. On the 30th, you're going to have Mark Vanderheim. He's an American that's been up there almost a year. When he comes down, he's going to have 355 days, just 10 days short of a year. He has now broken the other American record that was set by Scott Kelly and Christina Cook. They were also almost a year, but this guy's broke.
Sounds like Echo Link Audio flaked out, WB2BXL.
And because it's all civilian, NASA really is civilian, so is Roscosmos, the Russian end of it. They're not having a problem with military sanctions or anything like that. Any comments or questions? WSY.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead, Wesley.
Coincidental. Two Russians were found in yellow costumes with the blue stripes on it, and yellow blue is flag of Ukraine. Russia is actually invaded, attacked Ukraine. So that was a funny story, picked up by the media.
And that's actually not confirmed that was the purpose. Nobody's going to confirm that, Wesley. But yeah, I saw that. In fact, the three cosmonauts, they all went to a college. I forgot the name of it, a technical school in Moscow. And they all happened to go to the same one. And the colors of that school were yellow and blue. So now they say, well, maybe they chose that for that reason. Then the other people are saying, well, now, if they want, and they wanted to bring this up with them, you know, all these clothes and everything are packed like weeks or, you know, a month ago, you know, before any of this stuff started. So it's going to be for that reason. And then you read another report, oh, yeah, they smuggled it on, you know, at the last minute. So, I don't know. I take all of that with a grain of salt. I don't worry about it. I do know it's non-political up there. They actually depend on each other. They need the propulsion systems and the thrusters for the Russian side. And on the American side, you have all these solar panels supplying power to the ISS. And then they bring the voltage down for the Russian side. The Russian side runs on 28 volts. The American side runs on 120 volts. But it's all supplied by the big American solar panels. They have four moment gyros, these gigantic gyros that are roughly in the center of the ISS in the Z1 structure. Right above the Unity module. And these things spin at 6,000 RPM. And then there's big motors that are attached around it that these things are basically sitting in one position and the motors rotate. You can turn the station. You know, they actually rotate the station one way or another. You know, they always have like the cupola module. That's the one that where they can look out looking straight down at Earth. And, of course, you know, if there was no constant rotation of that ISS, you know, when they went on the other side of the Earth, they'd be looking at the stars. So they need the orientation and the solar panels, for power. Well, they need that for the USS, USA part of it, and the Russian part, of course, for propulsion and everything. And if there was a problem, I mean, theoretically, if there was a problem, the Russians, all right, that's it, we don't want to do this anymore. We still have that capability of pushing the ISS forward to keep its altitude. In fact, we have a Cygnus spacecraft attached to the ISS right now. Planned years ago, that eventually that's going to be used as the Cygnus to do just that. And it's so much that they gave that job of future ATVs. Took that exact same design and then modified it quite a bit, and that will be the service module to the Artemis program when we start launching Artemis to the moon. In fact, that's coming up probably in May. For the first launch, it'll be unmanned, but it should be pretty good. Artemis, I hope I didn't time out here. Artemis 1 was rolled out to the launch complex 39B, where it will eventually launch probably in May. And it was the first time that the crawler, crawler transporter set up, brought the whole space transportation system, the STS, out to launch complex 39B. They actually had a big deal. You know, they had the head of NASA there, Bill Nelson, and thousands of people that worked on the project. They watched it roll out of the vehicle assembly building, the VAV. And a big door's opened up, and this thing comes crawling out. And it takes a long time to get, you know, this 4-mile trip all the way to where it's got to go at Launch Complex 39B. So it's got to take roughly 11 hours to get there, and that's what it took. But they're getting ready for that flight in May. So the idea was to bring it out there now, loaded up with fuel, over 700,000 pounds of liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen. It also has two gigantic solid boosters attached to it, similar to what you saw years ago in the space shuttle. And, they roll that out, and they'll load it up with fuel. They'll do a simulated countdown all the way down to, 10 seconds before, and then they'll stop the count. And then make sure everything's okay. They'll bring the whole setup back to the vehicle assembly building, and may bring it back out again for a launch to go around the moon, unmanned, of course. It's the first time it will be launched. It won't be manned until Artemis 3. Artemis 1 will be unmanned. It's got the crew vehicle on it. I mean, if you were sitting there, you'd be able to breathe. In fact, what they're doing is sending three mannequins up there, two women mannequins and one man mannequin. The man mannequin is the commander. And they have all kinds of, you know, test equipment, sensors, and sonic weather attached to these things, to these dummies that will be sending information back to mission control during the flight. I think it's roughly a 22-day or 23-day mission. So they'll go out to the moon, go into orbit, and stay there for a while, and deorbit and come back to Earth and land in the Pacific Ocean. And they want to make sure everything works. The space launch system, which consists of the main core, which has the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, and two solid boosters. Everything has to light. It has to get up into orbit around Earth, and then the boosters have to separate after 2 minutes. The core tank will, with the four engines, will separate after about 8.5 minutes. Those liquid helium oxygen engines, the core, service module, that will separate. And the only thing that's going to come back is the command module with the three dummies in it. Artemis 2, when that goes, 2 years from now, play. Four will actually have a crew of four. That's the plan, right now. It will duplicate this whole flight, you know, launch, separation of all the different stages, orbiting the moon, and then come back. Not going to land on the moon. Artemis 3 will land on the moon. That's the plan. The earliest it looks like is 2025 for that. They'll have one of these SLS launches roughly once every year until the far distant future. Plan on eventually setting up a gateway space station around the moon, eventually some kind of a station actually on the moon, permanent base on the moon. And after all those years are gone, they plan on using the SLS to eventually start sending people to Mars. That's the long-term plan. I hope I live that long. Any comments or questions? WS2N.
Paul?
Yes, Roy, I'm still here. I hope I've been coming through okay.
Yeah, I just want to point out something that I've noticed has been going on Echolink. For some odd reason, it seems to time out. I don't know why. It's probably set to a different time interval than the repeaters are. So occasionally what happens is I see a text message that says W2VL-R exceeded TX time limit, and then it cuts out your audio feed. And by just clicking the transmit on my Echo Link, I was able to reestablish the audio. It introduced a courtesy beep into the transmitted signal. Frank has been doing the same thing previously. So I just wanted you to know about that. I emailed Lou. Probably needs to tweak the TX limit on the Echo Link application.
Okay. Are you saying maybe I'm better off going through Glen Oaks?
My guess would be part of this is the interaction between using Selden, because no one else does that. And I think you're primarily the big guy using the Selden repeater. So unless your signal was bad in Glen Oaks, you probably won't introduce this variable if you go through Glen Oaks instead of Selden.
Okay. We're going to talk about it. How about now, Roy? That's the signal.
Well, it's about 40% noise. Maybe you could turn your rotor to a better signal strength?
Okay. Yeah, I'm going. Yeah, signal strength to receive anyway is all the way up. I just went up to a higher power. How about now?
Okay, I mean, I can understand everything that you're saying. The audio isn't quite as sweet as going through Selden, but if you want to try it as a little experiment, we can add that to another email I'll send Lou when he's tweaking the settings, because it's probably something to do with the time limit of Echolink. And I think that's at Glen Oaks, so maybe that's what's doing it. The link going through is mistimed.
Okay. Well, I pumped up the power, and I'm pointing due west. Well, we'll see anyway. You know, last week we talked about cell phones possibly being used for for space communication. You'd be able to, you know, bounce a signal off a off a satellite. And then, of course, they're not there yet. But I looked into it. There are two companies that are trying to do just that. They're going to start off with text with your cell phones. But give it a year or two. They're looking for a ride in space. They'll probably there's so many companies launching rockets now. They'll find something to be able to do that. There's one company, AST, Space Mobile. They're trying to do it now for some kind of cell phone compatible broadband constellation.
and they'd like to get a couple of satellites up this year. And then there's another one called Virginia-based Link Global, also trying to do the same thing. So who knows? Well, maybe that will come true to someday, but yeah, I think it's going to be tough for a cell phone conversation to be had. But, you know, I could see the text possibly working, though. I could see that. Any comments, questions? WS2N.
WB2BXO.
Hi, Frank. If I'm making it okay. You sound very good through Echo Lake. How you doing?
Yeah, very good. Yeah, I see no reason why. Well, there probably are some reasons, but I would think cell phones going directly to an LEO constellation, low Earth orbit, would potentially work. I mean, ham HTs on ordinary FM make it to LEO satellites with the rubber duckies and low power, and some of the LEO satellites are running even less power than our HTs, 100 milliwatts or so. So it sounds feasible to voice, and when you're talking about orbits of a few hundred miles, latency would be low enough. I've used, an Iridium phone on a cruise ship, and the audio and latency was so good that my parents didn't realize I was on a cruise somewhere in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Go ahead.
Okay, Frank, very good. Okay, you did work the Iridium satellite. That was at least 66 satellites up there. That was the goal, 66. Well, that's why they called it Iridium. 66, electrons in the orbit of Iridium, so they named it after that. And they were going bankrupt, and then they came back to life, and then, from what I understand, they've been doing good for many years now. I don't remember the altitude of those, so, if you can get these low-earth orbits, LEOs, down to, a couple hundred miles. SpaceX is like 350 miles, still above the space station. But if you could do something like that, I guess that would be okay. Do you remember how high the Iridium was?
I'm sure we can Google it. I'm just in the middle of something else right now. I don't think they're very high, though. I'm pretty sure their LEOs are at least MEOs. And you're talking about I think they call it Iridium Next. I think that's the current version of the Iridium satellites. When I used it, it was probably about 5 years ago or more that I used an Iridium phone on a cruise ship. So they've at least been trying it out for a while. Go ahead.
Very good, Frank. That's pretty good that you got a chance to do that. You know, even if I didn't have anybody to call, I'd want to call somebody just to do that. That sounds great. Let's see if I can go down to lower power. Let me see if this works. Now I'm on medium power. We'll see. We'll put this into the report for Lou. Okay, I wanted to mention the Parker Solar Probe. Parker was launched a few years ago on a Delta Heavy. I mean, that means three Delta 4 rockets that were strapped together. And it's, at the time, was the largest rocket amount of thrust that NASA could get out of it. They're still launching a couple more Delta 4s, I think. I think there's one or two more to eventually launch. No more heavies. And this one launched the very small Parker probe to orbit the sun, which was very successful in doing that. I think it's done half a dozen orbits since it has taken off.
And each time it goes in, it gets closer and closer to the sun. And each time it goes in, it goes faster and faster. It goes like, you know, 200,000 miles an hour, and then it's going up to 300. And within another year or so, it's going to be up like 400,000 miles per hour. Fastest object that we ever launched. Anyway, Eugene Parker got to see that launch a couple of years ago when it did go off. And but unfortunately, he did pass away. He was in his 90s when this thing took off. I think 89 or so, 90. And now, you know, he's 94, so he did pass away. But, you know, how many people get to see their dream? They named it after him. And he was a scientist that, you know, he proved, you know, the solar wind existed, you know, that many years ago, decades ago. So, they named the probe after him. He got to see it, and you know, went there to watch it take off. They shot pictures of him in a wheelchair watching it go. And so, I thought I'd bring that up. It had a massive, you know, maybe 1,500 pound spacecraft, and it was launched by the heaviest, most powerful rocket that we had. And the reason for it, they needed actually a lot of power to, called, like, slow it down, or slow down the orbit, or get to the lower orbits below Mercury. To do that, he actually, you need a powerful rocket. They want to get to the lower orbits and then eventually use Venus and eventually Mercury to, you know, as gravity system, actually to bring it into lower and lower orbits. But each time they're doing it, they're actually increasing the speed. But anyway, Eugene Parker just passed away, so I thought I'd bring that up. Follow the Parker solar probe. Eventually we'll get within 4 million miles, and, you know, what they don't tell you is they, you know, when they write it like that, within less than 4 million miles, it's not from the surface of the sun. They say it's from the center of the sun. So it's actually a lot closer to the surface than one might think. So any comments or questions, WS2N.
Yeah, WB2BXO. What is the Doppler shift at 400,000 miles per hour? I'm sure it's easy enough to work out. I'm too lazy to do it. Not to mention how far off the spaceship's clock is offset from ours at that speed. Go ahead.
Yeah, when it gets in that close, it's doing all the research. It has, like, you know, 4 or 5 instruments on board, taking information for the scientists. They got the shield in front of it. So on one side it's like, you know, thousands of degrees, maybe 3,000 degrees or something, maybe more. And on the other side it's, you know, comfortable, you know, 80 degrees, I guess. Pretty all the electronics. And they actually have a cooling system involved with this whole setup too. But I don't think they worry about the Doppler, because after it comes around, it stores all the data, and then as it comes around, then it starts transmitting the data back to Earth. I think it's one of those deals, you know. So it's just storing, you know, they store and close, they take the information, and then eventually they send it back. They have to do that because they have to orient the antenna to Earth, and they can't do that if they're going around the sun at that close speed, distance and high speed. So they wait until they're, you know, it's a highly elliptical orbit, so they wait until they come out, you know, past Mercury, or maybe they actually each orbit they can come out to Venus, and then they go back in again. I think it's one of those deals, Frank. Doppler shimmers. at that speed is incredible. They got the same problem with Juno. I think they get up to 180,000 miles an hour when it comes in closest to Jupiter. You know, that's the one in orbit around Jupiter. You know, even today. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah. I remember I played on a number of occasions with the amateur LEO, and at one time the Astro 10 at one time, and being amazed at how big the Doppler shift was on those. It seemed kind of weird to chase the Doppler shift on my HT when I made a couple of contacts on the LEO FM birds. So, I mean, chasing the Doppler shift on this must be ridiculous, but I'm sure that's all automated. And then, of course, the timing of the data pulses is probably screwed up by time dilation effects, which are probably noticeable but not huge at that speed. Though, again, that's something that's easily calculated and probably compensated for when the data's processed. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. I know they all work this stuff out before they do it. It's amazing that they are successful in all these different deep space missions. There's about, I think, at least 40 deep space missions going on now, different types. And they need more antennas. You know, we have the Deep Space Network at Goldstone, California, Madrid, Spain, and Canberra in Australia. And Madrid, you just got another antenna. I just read it the other day, 110, 111 feet in diameter. So now, you know, they each have three or four of these massive antennas at different locations. So, you know, it's not like one antenna is in Goldstone or one in Madrid. You know, they have like three there now. And they just went operational. It takes them a couple of years to build it. So they had a video of the assembly of this thing, you know, over time. It all speeded up. It was pretty good. So now they have another one in Madrid. And it's a big deal for them, too. You know, I mean, they do have a space program. They're heavily involved with the European Space Agency, the United States, and the programs, sending satellites up all the time to different groups. But this is a big deal for them. They actually sent the King of Spain out for, I want to call it cutting ceremony, some kind of ceremony, when it first opened the other day. But, you know, that's what they need. So there's like, you know, 14 of these antennas around the Earth, you know, set at 120 degrees apart, always looking out, getting information back, you know. Spacecraft that were launched decades ago, including Voyagers. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 still out there, still sending information every day, transmitting information, receiving information. Amazing. I'm looking at the time, Frank. I think I better turn it back over to Roy. And he can write his report up for Lou. I love that. Gives him something to do. Anyway, we're going to turn it over to you, Roy. We'll be on tomorrow night, Monday night, for the Club InfoNet, and followed by George with the Slap and Chop, and followed by Newsline. AC2GS, WS2N for the SpaceNet report. For the TechNet, back to you, Roy.
Very good. Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report, for all you do for the TechNet, and for all that you do with the club. And for your own edification, you didn't have any timeout or audio drop on Echolink while you were on Glen Oaks. So I will include that in the email to Lou. Once again, want to thank everyone out there who suffered the inconveniences of my Echolink connection. And I hope you enjoyed Andy's talk. I did. I love history. I love mathematics. I love all that stuff. And I hope we can visit the aspects of that again in the future. I thank everyone who participated tonight, and I'm sorry for a few people who were delayed so much that they had to leave the net before they had a chance to participate. I hope they'll come back next Sunday when we try and do this all over again, preferably using a radio instead of EchoLink. So we'll see how that works out for all of us. So once again, I just want to remind people to reach me. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to reach Paul, his is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Link page has a lot of links to interesting articles of the week. There's an article on how 360 was believed to be chosen. There's a nice little diagram of six equilateral triangles crammed into a circle and coming to 360 degrees. And there's a nice little cuneiform table in case you want to be able to write 1 through 60 in Sumerian cuneiform. Also, keep in mind that I stream the audio. My reception is fine from the repeater. It's transmitting to it that's the problem. So if you need an audio stream, just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that will give you an audio stream. Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site, amateurradio.tv, where he has archived the technical nets going as far back as September of 2006. So please avail yourself of that. And as I often mention, Dick used to end his episodes of the TechNet with something along the lines of be kind to each other. It's always good advice. It's especially good advice now. Be safe. Be smart. Be well. Take care of yourself. Take care of your loved ones. Hell, take care of your hated ones. Take care of each other, because we are the only people we have. So please, be well, be safe, and if you can, come back next Sunday night at 8 o'clock when hopefully I'll be back on the radio, and we'll do it all over again. This is AC2GS, formally closing this vernal equinox edition of the Limark Technical Net, and I am clear.
Thank you very much, Roy, Paul, and Andy. You all did a great job. Paul.
KD2GS, this is KD2VHD. Excellent job in spite of the difficulties. 73, have a good night.
Tarasu. It's perfect.
AC2GS, Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich?
That was short, but you have a pristine signal now. Are you still on EchoLink?
Yes, unfortunately, this is EchoLink now. I do not know what happened. At first, I thought maybe I needed to reset the radio, maybe the antenna failed, but these are two parallel radios. One is an ICOM 7100 on a GP3. The other is an FTM 400 on a Yagi, and they were erratic. The first time I used the FTM 400, and he heard me, and from then on, no one heard me at all. So I find it hard to believe two simultaneous radio/antenna failures. I assume that some reception lobe at the antenna site is not optimum for this far into Brooklyn.
Can you try it again now, or would that be difficult?
Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Loud and clear. Did you just switch to your radio?
Yes, this is the FTM 400. Let me switch back to the 7100.
Okay, this is the 7100. Do you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay, I'm cranking it down to the usual output because I had it cranked all the way up. So this is a temporary repeater problem. I cannot begin to get how two separate systems in my shack could simultaneously malfunction.
No, now you're totally